right, everyone. Welcome to episode 18 of the Interracial John podcast. I'm your host, at Leslie Mack, and I'm joined as always
by at Very White Guy.
And you are very white indeed.
Oh, thank you very much.
This is a great, awesome episode we have tonight, and we are joined by a special guest. Sherelle K is here from Americans United again. I'm so excited. Hey, Sherelle, what's going on?
Hey. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, thanks for being here. We're so excited. We'll do some housekeeping stuff, and then I'm going to talk to you for a minute, Sherelle. So we are the Interracial John. You can find us on iTunes or Stitcher. That's Interracial John, J-A-W-N. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or Tumblr at Interracial John. Again, that's J-A-W-N. And our awesome guest tonight is Sherelle K. She is the host and executive producer of the AUA Hope podcast, which features positive news and uplifting content. She also co-hosts the Americans United Again podcast with her boyfriend, Ricky, who's been on our show before. And the AUA podcast features political news and commentary along with policy discussions. Sherelle has always had a passion for storytelling and received her BA in journalism from the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. in 2007. During her time in Washington, Sherelle worked for the Washington Post, XM Satellite Radio, and she covered the 2008 political campaigns for MSNBC.com and NBC Network News. After leaving D.C., Sherelle saw a break from the 24-hour cable news cycle and moved to Los Angeles in 2009 to produce entertainment television shows. She currently works as a freelance TV producer and has worked on shows like Top Chef, Survivor, and Amazing Race, among others. Today, Sherelle seeks to create positive media for the masses, and podcasting is just one of the many ways she seeks to do this. So welcome to Sherelle.
Welcome.
Woohoo! Thank you guys so much for having me. I really appreciate you for giving me the opportunity to join you guys. I love your show, and it's just a privilege to be able to talk things over with you.
No, thank you. I'll give you a ding for being on the show.
Absolutely. Ooh, yeah. And I threw some positive news in here today, so we made you feel a little bit welcome. We're not, well, we don't slant one way or the other, but somehow these days it just feels like stuff's negative.
So we I think it's me. I think I'm the Debbie Downer.
Maybe so. Maybe
it's like white guilt or something. I'm just always like, I'm always angry.
Yeah.
Maybe I should be, because do you guys have angry white guy? Maybe that should be like.
We do, but even he's had to take a break. I think things are just so angry.
He can't sustain the anger.
Oh, that's hilarious.
A lot to be angry about.
So, Sherelle, tell us where we can find the AUA Hope and the AUA podcast and kind of all about the movement as well, because I know you guys have a larger plan beyond just the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. You can find the AUA Hope on Stitcher Radio. We're also available on iTunes. You can find us at on Podbean at auahope.podbean.com. But as far as the Americans United Again movement as a whole, Hope is underneath that umbrella. So Americans United Again is a movement. You can find us on Facebook. Search for Americans United Again. Also, we are on Twitter, AUADOTORG. And let's see, we have a website, auamovement.org. And if you want to find us on, what else is there? Oh, yeah, email. There's a million channels. Email us at AmericansUnitedAgain@gmail.com. And as far as the movement, Americans United Again is really about bringing people together. It's about having those conversations that really help us to talk about the issues and see the things that unite us and connect us all as people. And so the policy discussions that we have are really aimed at finding solutions for all. And the end goal for Americans United Again is to become a PAC, or really just a political force for good. And so we hope to add more shows. We hope to have more activism and really just make it a presence for positive change in the world.
Kudos. I really think you're doing a great job in that regard. Really. Honest.
Agreed. It's really awesome. And so we are happy to have you here and to discuss all of the happenings that we tend to jaw on about here on the Interracial John.
Well, Well, thank you. And I don't want to leave out my boyfriend, Ricky, because he's actually the one who founded Americans United Again. Shout out to Ricky.
Hey, Ricky.
And he's also part of the impetus behind Hope. He's, you know, sort of pushed me in the direction of having my own kind of show. So, Ricky, we know you're not on with us today, but you're with us in spirit. So, hello.
Yeah, that's right.
Hey, he's editing in the background.
That's right. He's out,
no,
he's out there.
He's always there.
Furiously working. So, okay. Yeah, so we have been, I guess, lamentably or not, starting usually with some Ferguson updates, just kind of talk about what's been going on. Obviously, it's been a pretty big week, and because of the holiday, we did do some podcasting. None of the stuff we recorded this weekend is up yet because we spent the whole weekend doing interviews with every member of my family that was here. So we're excited to get that out to everybody, but we didn't do any actual podcasting where we talk about.
And we talked a little bit about this when we did the dispatches from the Blue Room with
the Middletons.
The Middletons. Thank you. It's weird. There's something about, I don't know if you had this experience, Shel, but so we have a home office. I work from my home, and we have a little studio set up with our mics and everything. And something about putting a headphone on and a microphone in front of somebody really changes, like that Hawthorne effect. Like when you're looking at behavior, the behavior changes. Something about it with everyone from my mother-in-law to the littlest kid, they got really like, not oddly, but like super into it, like really engaged. Don't you think, Leslie?
Yeah, they were really into it, and they all were like, oh my God, that was so much fun, and they really enjoyed it.
Like,
so.
Mom was nervous. Oh, wow. She's like, are we going to record? What are we going to record? We have to go record. Are we going to record? What are we going to record? And then she was up here for like 45 minutes.
You guys were talking forever. We were all downstairs like, what? How can they still be talking?
I'm definitely not going to spoil it, but I'm just saying, for real, she was fucking hilarious. I was laughing out loud. Laughing out loud. She
I haven't heard it yet, so I'd be excited to hear that one.
Way fun.
Comes out, so.
I had a really good time doing all
be
of
on
them.
The lookout. So it's been our first time really being able to record almost since the
grand jury announcement,
really, because everybody started arriving on Wednesday. So obviously there have been literally a week of protests nationwide across the country. What has been the climate out in L.A., Sherelle?
L.A. has seen an increase in protests as well. I mean, I know that when Mike Brown was first killed, I don't think there was too much unrest here. It was mainly focused in Ferguson. But after the decision was announced not to indict, I know that there was a number of protests out here, some on the 101 freeway. There was also some out in downtown LA area. And really, people have been upset and feeling more so that it's not something that we can just let go by, that it's something that people need to keep paying attention to. Because I know that one of the complaints about the whole Trayvon Martin situation was that it just died out. All the outrage and all the anger, it was just so short-lived that people were like, oh, well, this is laughable that every time something like this happens, you get upset, but then you just forget about it the next day. And I think that people right now are saying that it's not going to be just some short-lived, it's not a fad. It's actually a growing movement that's gaining momentum.
Yeah. In fact, we're going to be talking about that a little bit later in the podcast, moving from a moment to a movement. And I know you're in LA, but did I read that they shut the BART down? Is that correct, Sherelle, Leslie? Did you hear about that?
Yeah, but that's up in the Bay Area, not in LA.
San Francisco, yeah. I'm not sure about that. I know, the only thing I know about is the stuff that happened here on the 101 and also down on Crenshaw. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, those were the biggest protests in the LA area. But in San Fran, I'm not too sure about that. I also know, some things about what happened in D.C., where I'm from, the whole Georgetown, a lot of the protests happened down there, and also the 395 freeway was shut down both northbound and southbound on the Sunday after Thanksgiving. So, I mean, it's really spread throughout the nation.
It was 170 cities, and I believe it was multiple countries, Japan, Norway, UK, Puerto Rico. I mean, this isn't a small thing. And at least I'll speak from my white perspective. I hear and see a lot of that within my Twitter sphere and my Facebook. There's just a sense of like, okay, you know, the grand jury didn't indict. Can you guys get over it now? Mm. Like, you know, justice was served. You know, we were waiting. Well, all the facts are in and they decided not to indict. Okay, you protesters, can't you get over it now? They're not getting it. They don't see that this is not. And even though a similar rhetoric that I hear is, what's so important about this case? Why Mike Brown? Why this case? And it's like, yo, it's not this one case. It just isn't.
No, not at all. I mean, he's an additional straw. The camel's back has been broken for some time. But, you know, it's every additional straw. Every single day when you hear about another shooting, it compounds an already pre-existing problem. And even people who say that they're sympathetic to the situation, like one of my friends had posted something about the 395 shutdown, and there was this white woman who was a friend of my girlfriend, and she said, oh, well, I'm all for protesting, but when you protest, can you at least protest on the side and not get in the way of traffic?
Don't inconvenience me.
Yeah, she's like, because it's so inconvenient. It's so goddamn inconvenient for me to have to for me to be in traffic on the way home. And I was like, so it's not inconvenient for our black sons to be killed every single day. Like, it's less convenient. Like, I just kind of went off because I was like, how you have the audacity to say that you're sympathetic to the cause, but your biggest concern is a traffic jam.
Yeah.
It's kind of nuts.
My fucking latte is going to get cold.
Yeah. But I do think that there's definitely this like disconnect, I think. And I think that when people do ask me what's different now than, say, with Trayvon, two things, obviously, an extrajudicial killing when the police are involved is very different than a citizen citizen murder. So that's one thing that separates this from that situation. I also think that there was a trial in that case, and though it may not have been a just outcome, it did occur. And so I think that also kind of takes the wind out of sails. And then the third thing is just that the state's response in Missouri has been so egregious that it's impossible to not have that echo, just make these huge ripples across the country, because this situation and the way that black people in this country have been treated, specifically by law enforcement, has just gotten out of hand. And we have cultivated in this country an atmosphere that respects the rights, needs, and decisions of law enforcement above all. Oh, it's a very dangerous place to be. It's very dangerous for democracy. It's very dangerous for justice. And it's very dangerous for society to be in the place that we are right now. And that's the thing that upsets me when I look at white people not taking this as seriously as they should. It's like, do you not understand that this is about you too? Yeah. If you think that allowing what I consider and have been considering since August 9th occurred, Missouri to become a police state where you literally surrender your constitutional rights the minute you step foot in that state, it's a coup. That is what has gone on in one of our 50 states. A coup has occurred. Our federal government has done nothing about it, and the citizens of this country have just watched.
Well, and
black people are not, we're just not here for it, because if it can happen there, trust, when black people start being upset about something in Atlanta, when they start being upset about something in Miami, the same shit will happen.
Well, and you hit it on the head, this notion that law enforcement's infallibility, because they're human, they're people, they fuck up, right? But their infallibility is just beyond reproach. It allows them to operate with impunity. And that just this whole, like, they make split-second decisions, they put their life on the line. It's like driving a truck is a much more dangerous fucking career. Do we allow truck drivers to roll over people and be like, nah, he's a truck driver. You know, it's okay. He can get away with it. No big deal. This whole infallible police officer is just absolutely absurd.
I take it one step further than that even, because it's not even about protecting them. Let's just say that that's an okay position to come from, that protecting you is important. Let's say that. Okay.
It's a big if.
It's not an if. I protecting myself as a human being is very important. So I don't think that that's an infallible notion to have. My problem is that your safety does not equate loss of life on the other end of the equation. This is where the police have a problem with me, is that this idea that the only way to protect me is to kill you.
Well, and let's make it clear. Loss of black life. Because they get in trouble for shooting dogs. They get in trouble for fucking literally killing dogs.
And let's assume I'm talking about black life. But I'm just saying, this is where I have the problem. It's not just about this. And this is a systemic problem. This is what they're taught. I say this all the time. It's like, oh, when Darren Wilson says, why I was doing my job. You know what? He was doing his job.
Yeah, that's the problem.
That's what the problem is.
Why is that his job?
He was trained to fear black people. He was trained to kill them if they get shot by him. And he was trained to cover it up afterwards.
Right. But he could have at least had a taser. I mean, that's the thing.
He could have, but he's not required to.
Yeah. And
that's problematic, is the fact that lethal force is the first means of action on their part. Like, that's not your first line of defense. That's the last thing you do. And I think that that's part of why we do have to really change the expectations for the police and not let them off so easy. Like, oh, well, you know, that's just the way it's always been done. So therefore, you know, we're going to allow this to happen. It's similar to, I think you guys had shared a story about the old law, how it used to be constitutional for police to shoot at you if you were running away.
Mm-hmm.
And now that's no longer considered legal. So we can raise the bar when it comes to police officers and what the expectations are. I just think that it has to be brought to someone's attention, and we need to change the laws.
And you actually, that's a good segue. We're going to, maybe I'll skip around as our outline, Leslie, but you just mentioned the grand jury actually received this outdated law, and I'm going to play a sound clip, but give me just a second. I'll play it. And while we're doing that, Cheryl, maybe I'd ask your opinion, because Leslie and I have talked a lot about this fact that I think, this is my hypothesis, that a lot of the awakening, in particular for white people, maybe you can't speak to that, but just the awakening is happening in general, is because the decisions that law enforcement and the prosecutors and the people in charge are making are so over the top. It's like they're not even trying to hide the fact that it's fucking racist as shit, right? So, like, not just Mike Brown and the dog whistle with releasing the alleged strong-armed robbery, but you've got Akai Gurley getting killed in his own fucking home, walking down a stairwell, and then fucking Giuliani going on and saying, well, if you black people weren't killing each other, white cops wouldn't be there, right? And now you've got the most recent one, Tamir Rice, 12 years old, 12 fucking years old, and they're smearing him. They're talking about his parents had, you know, problems with domestic violence, and there was this. He's fucking 12. Like, nowhere are they treating him like a victim. It's crazy. I'm going to cue this up.
And when you sit back and let that kind of stuff fly, then you know deep down there's something in you that says this is wrong. And I think you're right about that. I think you're kind of forced to awaken when it's that obvious. But the problem is, it has to be that obvious in order for people to wake up, because they'll find any reason to say, oh, well, it's your fault if you pull your pants up, and if black parents were better with disciplining their children, then they wouldn't be burying their sons. I mean, people will find any reason to blame the victim. And at some point, it has to become overwhelmingly clear that these people they didn't deserve to die.
Absolutely. For sure. All right, we're going to play that clip now. Let's play it.
Just before Officer Darren Wilson testified to the grand jury investigating his killing of Michael Brown, the assistant district attorney handling the case said this to the grand jurors. I'm going to pass out to you all. You are all going to receive a copy of a statute. It is section 563046, and it says law enforcement officers' use of force in making an arrest. And it is the law on what is permissible, what force is permissible, and when in making an arrest by a police officer. The assistant district attorney, Kathy Alizadeh, then handed the grand jury a copy of a 1979 Missouri law that was ruled unconstitutional by the United States Supreme Court in 1985. She was handing them something that had not been law in Missouri during her entire legal career. But it was very helpful to Officer Darren Wilson that the assistant district attorney handed the grand jury an old unconstitutional law which said incorrectly that it is legal to shoot fleeing suspects simply because they are fleeing. By handing the grand jury that unconstitutional law, the assistant district attorney dramatically lowered the standard by which Darren Wilson could be judged. She was telling the grand jury with that document that Darren Wilson had the right, the legal right, to shoot and kill Michael Brown as soon as Michael Brown started running away from him. She was telling the grand jury that Darren Wilson didn't have to feel his life threatened at all by Michael Brown. She was taking the hurdle that Darren Wilson had to get over in his testimony and flattening it.
So that happened. I mean, there's been so much. I really have just been kind of stealing myself off from the act, from pouring through the grand jury reports and information, because I know I'll just become completely obsessed, like Howard Hughes style. And like my nails will get really long and I won't leave the room. And it'll be
walking
really
around
bad.
With like fucking tissue boxes.
Yeah,
on your feet.
It'll be really bad.
Yeah, we don't want that.
No. So I've just allowed, you know, as things have come out, kind of digesting them slowly but surely. And so this one obviously was a pretty big red flag, because it just seems like grounds for there to be.
Can you do? Is there, when there's a trial, you can have a retrial, you can have a fucking mistrial, you can have, right. When the grand jury doesn't indict, what's the other, is there an alternative? I don't know.
You can bring a case back to the grand jury and go for indictment again. No. You can do that. You can bring it back again. You can say, okay, we didn't have enough evidence at this point, but now we do. This happens often in cases, especially when, like, a RICO case, larger cases that people are trying to build against corporations, things like that. I know that happens in New York quite often, where, you know, the prosecutor wants to bring charges, but it's somebody powerful or rich or something like that. So they need to make sure the grand jury says okay. So it's not as though that door is closed. It's just painfully obvious that nobody, literally nobody in the justice system from top to bottom in Missouri has any interest in that. So it's not going to happen. They've made it very clear. Their goal in the outset was to never have Darren Wilson be responsible or held responsible for this killing. Because in their mind, just like in his, they have no remorse and he did his job.
Yeah. The number and amount of lies, miscues, deliberate subterfuge, it's staggering. And when white people say this, like, you know, he didn't have his hands up, you know, that's what they said, justice was served, it's like, really? It boggles my mind.
And they just play on the same thing. You see it in politics all the time. It's just like this whole, like, birther thing with President Obama. Somebody out there, they put it out there, you know, the conservatives, he's a Muslim. He's from Kenya. He's not even American. It persists to this day, despite the fact that this man is clearly American. He clearly was born in this country. This is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard of. And it's the same thing with this whole Darren Wilson. I guarantee you there are a good percentage of people in this country that, despite the fact that we now have all the evidence out here, believe that first fake picture of some guy with his orbital bone broken and say, look, he was beaten up by this monster. You know, they believe this stuff.
Yeah, no, he looked like he was blushing at best.
I saw a picture that showed him from the interview and the mark on the side of his face was still there. It looks like a birthmark. It doesn't even look like an actual mark.
And Cheryl, did you see the Nancy Grace interview on CNN?
No, I didn't.
You'll have to see it out.
Maybe you should pull that up, Drew, while we're talking about this.
All right, because I'll just say this. I fucking hate Nancy Grace.
I hate Nancy Grace.
I think she's like all that's fucking horrible about, you know, her Casey Anthony coverage, all sorts of shit is just, you know, tot mom, hot pants and blah, blah, blah. I can't fucking stand her. And she, Nancy Grace, is saying this is a travesty, right?
Yeah, like, let's pull that out and we'll play it.
White people, when Nancy Grace is on your side.
It's crazy.
Huh?
Hmm? Why don't you guys think about that.
Keep talking.
So yeah, we'll talk about Black Friday a little bit. So obviously that was the announcement was made Monday, which also a thing that really pissed me off was the timing of when they decided to announce it and how they did.
Eastern.
Why? Just because they wanted this. This is what they wanted.
They were hoping that people were going to be upset and pissed, and it was going to be late at night, and they wanted people to fucking be reacting.
Yeah, they wanted the soundbite to be about the protesters and not about the miscarriage of justice that had occurred. I don't think they succeeded because I think that's why I was really happy to see the nationwide protest, because it allowed it to be like, okay, look at all these other cities across the entire country that are able to come out and protest in huge numbers. New York City, they shut down every bridge. They shut down the Lincoln Tunnel. I mean, it's the biggest city in the entire country, and they brought it to a halt. Yet nobody was injured. None of the police had to spray pepper spray on anybody. There were no rubber bullets fired. There were no tear gas canisters flying on the Upper East Side. I just feel like it was a lesson to the country that it's not about the protesters. That's not what's different in Ferguson. It's the police that are different. And I was really happy to see so many peaceful protests going on, and some not even that peaceful, some very emotional and cantankerous. But the police understood their role there was not to stifle people's First Amendment rights, but to be there to support that. And sometimes that means getting yelled at in the face. So fucking right. What, man? You got trained. If this is the worst you have to deal with, somebody yelling at you, okay, fine.
Yeah, what kind of cop are you? Remember the first on August 12th when all the real, like, crazy fucking militarized shit happened? They were like, a water bottle was thrown at us. A fucking water bottle?
Yeah, they can't.
That's what started this? A water bottle?
So anyway, so these continued, and then it's ridiculous. Even to say it is ridiculous.
Football players too. That was a good move. The Rams players coming out with their hands up
last night. That was nice. Although there's been a little news on that as well, which I'm hoping is not true, but apparently the vice president of operations for the Rams apologized to the St. Louis Police Department today.
Well, first of all, let's tell the full story. Was it McCullough or Nixon who came out and threatened the...
It was Ruja, of course.
Of course. Asshole Ruja.
Of course.
Wrote a scathing letter saying, like, if the Rams players put their hands up, this is an affront against the police and blah, 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 blah. So what did the fucking rich-ass fucking white dude that owns the Rams come out and apologize?
Well, it says allegedly, so don't be slandering people on my show. Thanks.
I can slander the NFL
everybody.
I've got Nancy queued up, so here we go.
All right.
Oh, yeah.
Now, HLN's Nancy Grace. And Nancy, thank you for coming on. I just want to begin. There's a lot we can talk about. Was there any one thing you were waiting to hear from Officer Wilson that he just didn't say?
Yes. You know, when people say it just doesn't add up, I'll tell you what doesn't add up. These photos. Because I was expecting to see, and we've all seen them, I've looked at them, I have studied them, I was expecting to see his face mangled. And I hear what he's saying, that he was afraid and this happened and that happened, but I always go back to the beginning, and the beginning is this. You got an armed man and an unarmed man. The unarmed man is shot 6 to 7 times. One of those may be a reentry. That's why it may be six. 6 to 7 times. He unloaded many, many more bullets. Why? He doesn't even have a bruise, right? It's red. He's got a red mark. I don't see it. And another thing, when he says, it all happened so fast I couldn't think, then later says, I paused and thought, can I legally shoot him? Listen, that doesn't add up. There's so many things that
he
don't
says
add
he didn't
up.
Have other options. That's from the mouth of Officer Wilson.
Look, do you know how many times I've ever sided against a cop? Never. But to me, this is bigger than a badge. And I don't like speaking out against a cop, but this doesn't add up. And another thing, grand jury. I have presented to grand juries so many times, I can't even count them. On a single day, we would present 75 to 150 cases to a grand jury, and we would do that two times a week when I had grand jury duty. I feel that the district attorney, as much as I respect him in other ways, used the grand jury to do what he wanted them to do as his tool. He didn't want to drop it. He presented it in such a way that this grand jury would not bring charges, and I don't like that.
I know a lot of people agree with you, and let me just let me tap into your knowledge just as a prosecutor, because you hear this from Ben Crump and then the team on the Michael Brown side saying they were frustrated. They felt like, you know, the testimony of the grand jury, i.e. the testimony from Officer Wilson, especially when he likened himself to a five-year-old and felt like Michael Brown, you know, like Hulk Hogan, was coming at him, and that his credibility and his testimony wasn't challenged. Is it the DA's responsibility? If you're at a grand jury, is it the prosecutor's responsibility to challenge that? Is it the grand jurors to ask questions? What was missing?
The grand jurors are like sheep. They're babes in the woods. The prosecutor's duty is to seek the truth. And here's the difference between me and Crump and Parks. I'm not paid one way or the other. My paycheck does not depend on my opinion. I'm not working for anybody except the truth. And I am telling you that prosecutors, if they want an indictment, they will get an indictment. When I went to a grand jury, I went to the grand jury on each case because I believed the offense had been committed and I had the right guy, or the police had the right guy. And I went in there to present them our evidence. If I didn't think there was a case, I would never have gone to the grand jury. You don't use the grand jury to achieve your personal gain, to achieve what you want them to do. You go in to get a true verdict. And, you know, I mean, please. There's nothing here. There's not even a bruise. And what you said about Hulk Hogan, remember, when he said he felt like a five-year-old battling the Hulk Hogan, that's when all he was battling was an arm in his patrol car. What, the arm is like Hulk Hogan? It doesn't add up. And his minute detail. This whole thing happened in 90 seconds. How did he have time to pause and think, can I legally shoot him? He also said, I only wanted to do one thing, and that's live. Well, if you wanted to live, then put the pedal to the metal and drive when the guy's trying to jump in your car and grab your gun.
Yeah, please.
So that's Nancy Grace's take on the grand jury information.
I agree with her. Completely.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no...
Say that again. I agree with Nancy Grace?
I know.
Holy shit.
I mean, I never thought I would say that, but I totally agree with Nancy Grace.
It's crazy, and that's why everyone is so upset about this. That's what makes this case, I think, so specific. And I liken it to all the time. I think about when in Selma, when the three civil rights workers were killed. I liken it to that because there was a feeling there in Selma that these people could do whatever they wanted to, because they've been doing whatever they had wanted to for so long that they thought, man, fuck these three guys. They're going to try and come down here and tell us what we need to do and try and get rights for people. We're just going to kill them. And it was like, whoa, 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 whoa. That's way too much. This is what's going on in Ferguson. It's what's going on in Missouri, that they've been doing whatever they wanted to for so long that they're so blatant and egregious with their the miscarriage of justice and the way that they're treating people so unfairly. There's no way to look at this and think, oh yeah, this is correct. Even Nancy Grace has to look at this and
be
like,
so many white people are, Leslie. So many white people still are looking at it.
But they're not looking at it, Drew. They've pre-decided. This is not the same thing as somebody that you show everything that happened. I have yet to meet a white person that I've shown everything that happened and then come out of that and say, yeah, I still think he deserved to die and nothing went wrong there. I have yet to have that. I've had white people that have been completely misinformed from the get-go and refused to listen to what I have to say. That's completely different. I have not presented this information to a single person, the real facts, and them not say, yeah, this is fucked up.
One part of that's right. Go ahead, Cheryl.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Cheryl.
I was going to say, a lot of people still believe that Mike Brown went on a rampage and robbed a you know, liquor store and stole some cigars and or convenience store and stole some cigars and then wrestled the cop and was, you know, 400 pounds and the cop was only 200 pounds. Like, people believe this crazy story that doesn't even exist. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a big part of why when they see the protesters and they see these so-called, like, big, huge riots, which really aren't the prevailing truth of the movement, they're likely to believe that it's just a bunch of misguided violence and they don't want to hear any of the facts. But the truth is that this is a very, very clear case of misuse of force, and Darren Wilson should have been indicted, especially because of what you were saying so earlier, which is that it is very easy to get an indictment and it's very unlikely not to get one in most cases. And I've heard people say you could indict a ham sandwich.
Yeah.
If the prosecutor really wanted it, then they would have gotten it. So I just think it's just a clear case of, you know, the justice system failing.
Complete failure from top to bottom, and just all of the leaks from the grand jury, the fact that the grand jury wasn't even sequestered when all of this stuff was happening in their area. I mean, so much of it is just kind of crazy. It was just clear. And what upsets me is, and I remember this coming out of the initial weeks of the protest, where you would hear protesters say, you're going to let this whole city burn down for one cop?
One
really?
White cop.
Really? You're going to let this happen? And it was like, yep. That's exactly what we're going to do.
Leslie, you and I have talked, and I've pivoted over the last 3 months. I started with, you know, silent white people, you're tacitly approving of this racist regime. Then I would sort of went a little heavier and said, you know what? You're no longer tacitly approving. You're complicit. And now I'm going even harder and saying, you're straight up betraying our citizens of color. And I'll even go one step further. I've honestly got to the point where, and I'm going to say this, you know, friends on Facebook, you listen to this podcast, if you, as a white person, can look at this in any sort of way, with any sort of, you know, information, you're not totally ignorant, you're not like sleeping under a fucking rock in a cave. If you can look at all of this information and you can still say, Darren Wilson, he's okay, he doesn't need to be indicted, justice was served, any of this sort of fucking rhetoric that's like, you know, he deserved to die, blah, 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 I'm going to go and say that that's absolutely willfully racist. You are, because it's like, it's one thing to say, well, white people just don't know, they're not informed. Nope. If you look at this in any sort of objectivity and you still conclude that Mike Brown is dead is okay and Darren Wilson free is okay, I'm calling you a racist. Because what's the other conclusion? What's the other fucking conclusion? There isn't one.
All right, calm down. So, but I think that, as Cheryl was saying earlier, that this is bigger than just this moment, which I think Tuesday's protests were about the moment, which is, you know, finally, as we all had, you know, suspected that he was going to get away with it and nothing was going to happen as a result of the ending of Mike Brown's life. So coming out of that, I saw a lot of, okay, well, what's next? Now we have the information. Now what do we do? And I tip my hat to the organizers and activists and protesters and Ferguson, the leaders there, for really spending so much time preparing for this inevitability and taking the time to train, to have focus there. And because I felt their organization, I felt their light shining from Ferguson, and it was a big signal to all the other cities that were like, well, we gotta support them. We have to show that what they're doing means something, and they're not in this by themselves. And so you saw around the country people doing activities as well. And then we moved into the holiday weekend, which obviously Black Friday was a big focus again. And so the total blackout or blackout Black Friday protests started happening around the country as well, where people were protesting at malls and shopping areas and also just asking for people to not shop on Black Friday. What was the temperature about that whole aspect of it like out on the West Coast, Sherelle? Did you hear a lot about it, or was it not too...
I don't know. I I mean, I think among my friends, I know a lot of people were participating in the whole Blackout Friday movement. And I know that people were saying that they were just going to either stay home or they weren't going to even engage in any online purchasing. But then there was a few other friends who were business as usual. They were standing in line at Walmart. They were buying a big screen TV. So I can't really say for sure exactly how far reaching the whole boycott of Black Friday was, especially for the larger corporate entities. I know some people were saying they were just going to focus on like smaller Black businesses if they were going to do any purchasing at all. But I think that it's encouraging that the Black Friday numbers were down. I think it was, I think you guys said 11% yep. down from the prior year. So it whatever it was, I don't know if it was you know, what the cause was, but I hope it had something to do with the Blackout Friday
movement. I think it's worth noting, 11% is what they are telling us, right? I'm not saying that that's wrong or it's, you know, they're misgauging that, but they certainly could, right? If I was a retail aggregator and I was talking about sales and year over year, I might downplay that figure too.
Yes and no. I think there's some indicators they actually don't get to control, which because IBM is the back end for most of these retailers, that the data is pretty clean in the onset. And also the National Retail Federation, they need clean numbers as well because they use that for lots of different things, including taxation purposes and things like that, and also for stock trading. So I think the numbers are pretty clean. These are all publicly traded companies, and regardless of what they tell us now, they have to tell everybody truth soon enough. So I don't think that they would lie and then 4 weeks from now change things. But yeah, it did say that over the 4 day weekend, same store sales or physical store sales were down 11% to $50.9 billion, which was down from $57.4 billion last year.
Just say that again. You're talking $7 billion difference, double-digit decrease.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. That's amazing. It is. And, you know, I think it was a combination of things. I don't think it was just the Blackout Black Friday. There was also a big push against Walmart by Walmart workers and people against Walmart and their practices as well, which was good. It was kind of nice to see these two movements sort of flowing together towards a common goal. And so a lot of the activities, if they weren't at upscale malls, they were at Walmart. So it was good to kind of see that happening. Also, I think it'll be something we'll see a lot more of is some of these different movements where there's overlap coming together to do things together. I'm hoping that that's something that will catch on because it was very effective in this way. And
there's also you're talking about the difference in numbers. There was a shift from Friday to Thursday.
But this was the 4 day total, so it actually doesn't play into anything.
So 11% over the 4 days.
Yes, over the 4 days. Fantastic. It was down 11%.
Because I know that Thanksgiving itself was up, but that's because more fuckers were opening.
Correct. Obviously, you know, Cyber Monday was today. We don't know what came out of that. I'm sure some of those sales will shift to the online retailer market, but still. It's interesting. I don't think we have a good handle on what the numbers are, but I also think, and I've been saying this about this whole boycott, the idea of a boycott has been, it's very foreign to our generation and so even to the generation before us. It's been 50 plus years since boycotting was used in any real form, especially by the Black community. And so to me, it's like a muscle. We haven't used it in a long time. We're going to start using it. This is our first time flexing it. We picked up a very small weight. Maybe it was only 5 pounds, but maybe next time it'll be 10 pounds. And maybe the time after that, it'll be 25. And then we'll start clean and jerking by the time we're next year. You know, it's about building this idea in people's head that when we say we're going to boycott, what does that mean? And how many people can we get to say, okay, so if your friends bought a big screen TV this year, I'm sure some of mine did too. Maybe next time when this call comes out, they'll think twice about it because man, all my other friends didn't do that. So
exactly.
Yeah.
Well, and I think today marks the anniversary of Rosa Parks, sitting at the refusing to sit at the back of the bus,
right?
Which reminds us of the Montgomery bus boycott, and I think that's exactly what you're saying about how much lag time there's been between generations experiencing a real boycott of any sort of magnitude. But I think that this can be the rise of a new boycott, and we've seen how effective that was. We saw how the money that was taken out of the transportation system really hurt them and forced them to enact changes in laws. So I think you're right about flexing that muscle and realizing that it's a powerful tool.
And you hit it on the head with the money, because let's not forget the bus boycott in Alabama went on for almost a year. It's like 350 days, right? It was a long time. And the boycotts of – I was doing some research on the effectiveness of boycotts. And the last 30, 40 years, boycotts haven't been effective from a financial standpoint. They've really been more of about like shaming, right? So like it's about the companies that kowtow to boycott efforts.
Right.
Yeah, it's bad PR. And there's an odd sort of dynamic that if a company's got a really shitty reputation anyway, a boycott won't work from a PR perspective. But what we're talking about, what you just mentioned, this 11% figure, that's got nothing to do with PR. That's bottom line. That's dollars and cents. That's going to make a difference.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And then the team from Ferguson had called for a couple of other things to happen once we got out of the Black Friday, which was on Sunday. They had put a call out to clergy to use a specific scripture in their messaging from the pulpit that week, from Jeremiah. And then on Monday, which was today, they were really focused on student action, which was the Hands Up walkout at 12:01 Central Standard Time, which had over 80 just that were taught, that were registered, 80 different locations that were registered of people doing it. But judging from online, I saw so many schools, so many cities, so many universities doing this. And here in our small, very white suburban town, the elementary school did it. I was shocked.
Aww.
Yeah. I tweeted it and it got like 400 people retweeted it.
With their teachers and everything.
But the thing that kind of, you know, trolls will be trolls, but people are coming out saying like, oh, you're just, you know, teaching these kids how to be thugs and this. And I'm like, it's a all fucking white, like lily white little elementary school. And you're going to be complaining about them. It was crazy. Absolutely crazy. And I think we're running long, Leslie. I don't know if you want to skip the fire starting by the police, but we could just sort of reference it. Did you hear about that, Sherelle?
Yes, I did. I think we were watching the video of it yesterday, and yeah, it seems like they're really just trying to sort of stage these fires and make it seem like the protesters are destroying property and they deliberately set a car on fire. And it's just, it's really malicious.
Yeah.
I think, you know, and I'm glad that someone caught it on tape, because people need to realize that this is police trying to shape the narrative deliberately to make it seem like the rioters are the big problem. And because if they do that, then all the attention is on the protesters and not on them. And so I just think it's a really cowardly way of deflecting the attention from them.
And you said seems, at least from my perspective, when I watched that video, unbiased. This is a SWAT team in full riot gear lighting a car on fire next to Advance Auto Parts that burned to the ground. And it's agent provocateurs. They're trying to pitch the narrative that this, because, you know, we know that the leaders in Ferguson, they were doing, you know, de-escalation training. They were having 600-700 different people that went through training on how to go through this without having these sort of issues. So what did the fucking SWAT team do? Lit a car on fire that burnt West flooring it fucking to the ground. It's ridiculous.
Beyond that, though, I think the bigger issue for me is, and you know, if you declare a state of emergency in your state and you pull the lever and bring the National Guard in, to me, there shouldn't be a single goddamn fire.
Yeah.
What the fuck are you doing? And what is the National Guard doing if they're not stopping all of these things that occurred on Monday night and Tuesday from actually happening? It makes no sense to me. I don't even understand how anybody in this country can see this and be like, oh, it's the protesters. Is it? How can you say that it's the protesters? They said, we won't tolerate this, we won't tolerate that. And then they just, according to what happened, they tolerated it. It doesn't even make sense. Like, in common sense, it doesn't even add up. It's so ridiculous.
McCullough had read that press conference about, you know, we're protecting property and we got to protect property and property and property. And then here, his fucking SWAT team's burning fucking property down. Give me a fucking break.
Well,
yeah, no, it's all a farce.
It's completely crazy. But this is the thing, is I don't think white people believe it. Because in their, and this is what it is, they come to this situation with this idea that, like, the police are good. The police would never do that to somebody. If you only engage with the police if you must have been doing something wrong. They do not understand the reality of Black Americans, and that when we interact with the police, that is not the police that we interact with. And it's something they have to get through their heads, is that their reality is not the only one.
Well, and I wanted to actually just share one thing that one of my friends had posted online. And it was sort of comparing the United States to Germany. And he says that a professor, Brian Stevenson, was giving a lecture on Germany and the death penalty, in which the audience commented, "We don't have the death penalty in Germany." And of course, we can never have the death penalty in Germany. After which he said the room got very quiet, and another person followed that up by saying, "There's no way with our history we could ever engage in the system, in the systematic killing of human beings. It would be unconscionable for us to do so in an intentional and deliberate way to set about executing people." And it seems quite easy to imagine the global outrage, undoubtedly spearheaded by American self-righteousness, that would ensue if the state of Germany was executing people, especially if they were disproportionately Jewish. Mm. And yet, in the U.S., we're so wrapped up in creating the narrative of our own progress that we constantly fail to connect current events with a history that does not stretch back all that far, as if everything just happens in discrete episodes and not even necessarily from the same show. So it's just like comparing Jim Crow and the lynchings of young Black boys, and realizing that the same number of Black men are being killed as the ones during the Jim Crow lynchings. It's very similar to if Germany would all of a sudden be executing Jewish people at a higher rate.
Sure, that's deep as fuck.
No, it's so true.
It's dead true.
We recorded a very short, very late night rant just in response to the Ferguson decision, grand jury decision. And I had read an excerpt from Frederick Douglass, a speech that he made in 1852. It's called The Meaning of July 4th for the Negro. And he says, at the end of his speech, he says, "Go where you may, search where you will, roam through all monarchies and despotisms of the old world, travel through South America, search out every abuse, and when you have found the last, lay your facts by the side of the everyday practices of this nation, and you will say with me that for revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy, America reigns without a rival."
Fuck.
So, wow. This was in 1852. He was asked to speak in front of the president and a bunch of other people, and he was like, 4th of July? The fuck do you want me to talk about the 4th of July for? And so this was the end of his speech. He goes through a lot during the speech, but it struck me, I actually heard this performed in New York City a couple of weeks ago, the speech, and I was sitting there like, yeah, he could have wrote that yesterday. Like, literally.
Yep.
And I have hypothesized that this movement, the original civil rights movement was about rights, because Jim Crow was so oppressive and so impossible to deal with that all we really could fight for at that moment were these very concrete things. But this movement, to me, has to be about the acknowledgement and dealing with the systemic racism in this country, at the root of this country, and how it has been carried through every aspect of our society. This is what this movement is. A lot of people have tried to say before this, oh, you can't see the racism now. And I call bullshit on that, because you can see it. People have said, oh, it's not as in your face now. And I call bullshit on that. It's very in your face. And I think that is where this is why you see the outcry. Because these young people, they know what's going on. They're not stupid. They can see how badly the deck is stacked against them. And nothing anybody's going to tell them is going to make that not the case. So I'm hopeful that this can go from moment to movement, because I think that this idea of making this nation come to terms with this racist past and how that has informed its present so that we can create a better future is something that we have some teeth there. There's something to hold on to. And I don't think that's been there prior to now.
I hear you. And, you know, there was another, Sherelle, you said about the number of black people, you know, that are being killed by police greater than the number of lynchings. And I think I'm correct on this, but I may be wrong. I think there are more black men in prison right now than were enslaved in 1865. You know, wow. I mean, it's just like it's absolutely crazy. And the difference between Germany and why that would be so egregious for them, they had a truth and reconciliation style. Like Nuremberg, like they really came, you know, they came to Jesus with their atrocities and crimes. And we fucking, you know, I've tweeted it before. 9/11, never forget. Fucking Pearl Harbor, never forget. Slavery, Jim Crow, 400 years of oppression, atrocity, get over it, black people. You know? I'm serious.
I've seen that. Did you make that meme?
No, somebody else did, but it's powerful. Oh, okay. I love it.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, no, it's true. If we did it, you know, we don't want to think about it. And that's part of why the rest of the world laughs at us when these things happen, because we're always pointing the finger at people and being like, oh, my God, that's such a human rights violation. How could you do this? And then we do the same type of stuff to our own people. So it's just one of those things where, you know, if you're going to try to become the moral standard, then you have to clean up what's going on in your own backyard.
And we push our fucking form of democracy through like tanks and military might to the rest of the world. Like, oh, you should be just like us.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no thanks.
Yeah, but let's not make the world do that. So let's transition to my second least favorite goddamn subject these days, which is Bill Cosby.
Bill motherfucking Cosby.
And Cosby Gate.
That was like my like TV dad. Like I loved him.
Who didn't?
Yeah.
He was America's dad. I was talking about that today because I lamentably spent most of my afternoon arguing with fucking people that are out here spearheading the pro-Bill Cosby cause on social media right now, which I'm just baffled by the entire thing. And Jill Scott today made a series of tweets supporting Bill Cosby, saying she doesn't believe these allegations. She's waiting for proof. He's a wonderful person. These people are just trying to smear his legacy. And then she had the nerve to personally tweet to me, what would I do if this was my father? Really, Jill? For real? This is where we're going with this? What would I do if this was my father?
Jill Scott clearly don't know you at all.
First of all, I would hope to God that if I had my father asked in any number of ways, did you drug and rape 15 women, that he would unequivocally be able to say quite simply, no, and nothing else. I've yet to hear Mr. Cosby say that. Then she says to a bunch of other people, somebody says, and your voice resonates because you're a woman, a soldier for women. So imagine my surprise when I heard you were in fact taking sides with Bill. This is somebody that tweeted her. Jill tweets back, sides with Mr. Cosby? No. I side with substantiated proof when media/society is attempting to destroy a magnificent legacy, she says. Somebody else says to her, Ms. Jill Scott, for a world-traveled, educated woman and mother to take up for a man who has abused women in his past is disheartening, she says. I'm respecting a man who has done more for the image of brown people than almost anyone ever, from Fat Albert to the Huxtables. Yeah. So, of course, Black Twitter came for her, as we do, because we good like that. And so actually, I really wasn't fighting with Jill Scott. I just had said to, I just made a comment. She said something and then she replied back to me with this father question. And I replied back to her, well, let me ask you a question. What would you do if one of these accusers was your mother? I thought it was a fair question to ask. Nothing. Crickets.
Radio silence.
However, Lots of other people decided to, once I posed this question, to come at me because I'm the wrong one here. I didn't bring anybody's parents into this. But I'm wrong. Why is everybody coming for Jill? And then it took this crazy turn where they, honest to goodness, were trying to convince me that this was all a white supremacist plot to bring down Bill Cosby and, through him, Black America.
Wait a minute. Black Twitter came at you like this, or just people?
No, Black Twitter. Not Black Twitter, but Black people on Twitter, yes.
Suggesting that your tweet about...
It wasn't my tweet. They were saying that I shouldn't be coming after Jill Scott, because this was all a big white supremacist plot to bring down Bill Cosby, and by way of Bill Cosby, Black America as a whole.
All 17 women that have come out now and saying this has happened, they've got the exact same stories and similarities.
But I would stop you right there, because that is even a false statement to be made. It's not that all 17 of these women came out right now. Plenty of them filed these charges before. They have made these accusations before. This is not new information. It may be new to the general consciousness, but on record, it's not new at all.
Well, what was the plot, though? What did they think the plot was? I'm confused.
To take him down, because he represents, as Sherelle mentioned, America's dad.
But if all this has been known before, if these women had come out before, they have come out before, they've made statements before, his lawyer squashed it, how did this plot start like now? I don't understand what their logic is.
Their logic is that corporate America is the ones that have allowed this to happen.
Huh?
It doesn't make any sense. Don't try to make sense of crazy, because it's just them trying to take personally that they felt a certain way about Bill Cosby, and this is hurting them, and this is their way of dealing with it.
But isn't it sort of now in the light more because of the joke Hannibal Buress made? So he's the start of the supremacist plot to take down Black people and Bill Cosby?
Or at least the guy that taped him? I don't know. None of them make any sense to me.
That's the one dude who's in charge of all white supremacists was at that show in Philadelphia, taped it like, aha, I got it. I'm going to get them Black people and Bill Cosby. Bingo.
No, but it just reminds me of the whole thing with the street harassment video with the woman, because you would see Black men coming out being like, oh, you're helping them take Black men down because what? Because all of these douchebags were out on the street harassing this woman. And I would say the same thing about, well, it would be really easy to defend Dr. Cosby if, I don't know, he hadn't drugged and raped 15 fucking people. Like, how is that anything to do with anybody except for the fact that he's a drug, somebody who does those things, that he rapes women? I don't even understand it.
Well, it took me a long time to even come to terms with this, because I'm like the biggest Cosby Show fan. I have him on, DVD. I watch it on TV Land. I mean, I am Mrs. Little Miss Cosby Show. But once there was so many reports that really were so close and pretty much identical in what they were saying, also hearing him joke about, drugging women, the whole Spanish fly joke that he does. And even after the whole thing came out, he was joking later on during the week about how hurt he was, about how his reputation was going to be tarnished and no one was going to buy any more, Jell-O pudding. And it just seemed like a big joke to him. And I'm sorry, but if you have no remorse and you can't even speak out and say, this is patently false, I paid these people off because of X, Y, and Z. Like, give some form of explanation to the people who have looked up to you, for decades. And he just really hasn't shown any form of...
he may be... There's probably like civil lawsuits he's trying to avoid. Like, I understand financially. He could at least be like, no. He could categorically deny it. His whole, like, right, we're not going to talk about that, looks like a weird fucking... Like, I don't know what you call that, like a lateral arabesque fucking nope.
Lateral arabesque.
We're going to talk later about, like, non-pology, no-pology, and unpology. Well, this is a new one. We'll call this a cosmology. It's like I don't know what it is. And I don't mean to
stepped down from
Temple today. This is what spurred Jill. She went to Temple,
sure.
and she's from Philly. So this is actually what spurred her big, you know, needing to come out with her cape on, her big Bill Cosby cape to you know, talk to all of us bitches out here, make sure we know that Dr. Cosby's not what we should be talking about.
She should really, like, I'm not saying she doesn't know you, but ooh, coming at you.
She can come at whoever she wants to. There's nothing to do with that. What she needs to do is take her own advice and just be silent.
Yeah.
That's what she needs to do.
And you know what?
She's not very good at tweeting. Should tell her that.
Pharrell did the same thing, right? Like, came out.
But Pharrell is new black. So we're not talking about Pharrell.
I'm just saying, at some point, it's like, can people I kind of like musically just shut the fuck up? If you're not going to...
No, but that begs the question. You know, Sherelle, you mentioned you have the DVDs. You really love The Cosby Show. Does this diminish your enjoyment of the show?
Oh, totally.
It does.
It does.
Absolutely.
Really?
I feel that way about Seinfeld.
Yeah.
I watch Seinfeld and I see Kramer and I'm like,
The thing about the Kramer thing is that Kramer's not Michael Richards. It wasn't based on him and he just was playing a part. The difference with Dr. Cosby is that his show was his family. Theo was his son, Ennis. Like, all of the stories you saw in his stand-up, he brought them directly into the show, and it was supposed to be a reflection of the type of family that was okay.
Exactly.
But I start thinking about it now through a completely different lens now that all this stuff is coming out, of course, with his whole respect ability, you know, pull your pants up and single mothers and blah, 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 while he's drugging and raping women is completely ridiculous. And the epitome of hypocrisy almost has a, dare I say, pathological and, almost psychotic aspects to it, because it's a rare person to, while you're conducting this immoral and horrible behavior, feels the need to go in front of large groups of people that respect you and try and shame people.
Ugh.
Poor people.
That's kind of common, though. Like, you'll see it a lot in the religious sectors. Most homophobic person is the person in the closet. You know what I mean?
I made a joke about
Jim Haggerty. Isn't that guy's name?
When Barkley came out and started talking about black people turned down. I was like, is there some sort of like secret, like extra level of like white Illuminati? Like all you got to do when you're black and you get a lot of money is like shit on other black people and we'll give you the keys to the city.
Charles Barkley can't even speak English properly.
I know,
he's
it's like, at some level, it's like, is that part of the, like, the playbook, like the program? Like, okay, like, you want to get really, really in with white people, you got to shit on black people. Here you go.
Yeah, but that's like saying, like, Marv Albert is representative of all white people. Like, Charles Barkley is stupid. So I don't
remember when Marv Albert bit that chick in the
ass? That's my point. It's like, come on. It's not somebody you even, he's such a non-issue, a non-individual. Like, nobody takes him seriously. Somebody who went and told a police officer that he was driving drunk because he was going to get a really good blowjob from a stripper. Who does that?
I gotta give a triple ding for that.
This is the person that we need to be listening to what we need to do? No,
yeah,
I don't
think
so.
At least he was honest.
I guess there's that.
Sorry to tangentially pivot, but I'm seeing from Chris and Sanity Report, and I respect his veracity, that the Rams have officially said that they did not apologize and that the SLPD's claiming they apologized was a lie. So the Rams
favors. You know who wrote that for the St. Louis Today, of course?
Christine DeBuyers.
Your best friend.
Fuck that fucking bitch. Oh my God.
Stop.
Why is she a reporter? Why does anyone even listen to that?
No,
I'm going to call her a cunt. I call her a cunt?
No, you can't. Calm down. There's a reporter in for the St. Louis Today. Her name is Christine Byers. She's a horrible person, and she has been reporting direct. She's the source. She always has these inside sources. She's the one who had the orbital bone. She had the dozens of witnesses that corroborated Darren Wilson that never materialized, and now she put this report out earlier today. I have a running joke. Jamila and I have this running joke, Jamila from Ebony.com, where I say she's the number one call on the racist hotline. So it's like, oh, you have a story that puts black people down? 1-800-CALL-CHRISTINE. Because it's like every single time somebody wants to say something shitty about people in Ferguson, it's her end.
And let's not forget, she writes true crime books that requires her to have access to the police police department.
Yeah.
So what, you know, shocking,
but we're
surprise,
not talking
surprise.
About Christine. I just wanted to let you know. But
I didn't know that's where
we'll
that
came from. We'll do some more research
from.
And give an update on that the next
oh,
episode.
Oh, I can't stand her.
But what do you think about this whole Cosby thing and people like Jill Scott coming out? Just the defenders, I guess. What are your thoughts, Sherelle? Do you have any friends that have been defending him? What has been you do?
Best friends is still defending Bill Cosby. I just like look at her statuses and I just keep scrolling down because I don't know what to say. I mean, part of me wants to be like, yeah, of course he's innocent. But like, I mean, logically, I know that that's not true. I mean, and I've seen like Raven Simone speaking out and saying that he was nothing but, you know, respectful and kind to her on set. And I mean, of course he should be.
I mean,
he's not that stupid that he's going to walk around and try to drug and rape Raven Simone.
At eight. No.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, glad that he's smart enough not to do that.
But I also have noticed that a clear absence of any of the other actresses on that show saying anything.
Oh my God, you're right.
Their silence says something.
Lisa Bonet just disappeared off the show, and like maybe was that have something to do with it?
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's interesting.
She was a showman, and then she was gone.
She came back later, the very last season. I think they had her come back after she'd already been married and all that other stuff. And that's how they got Olivia or Raven Simone's character onto the show. But it's interesting. Tempest Bledsoe, Sabrina LaBeouf, and also Erica, oh gosh, the one that played Pam. I can't remember her last name. She was on Living Single.
Alexander
and Lisa Bonet. Not a word. Their silence is interesting.
Help me with my memory here. Did not Lisa Bonet do a video or some movie where she was nude?
She was in that Mickey Rourke movie, Angel Heart.
And that's what pissed him off, right?
Well, that's neither here nor there. I don't need to speculate.
I'm saying it's kind of weird that, like, you know, and to your friend Sherelle and other people that are defending Bill Cosby, let's not forget that the most heinous of, like, serial killers and rapists are always the, like, really nice fucking guy next door. Right? William Gacy was like...
I wouldn't agree with that.
Not always, but they're frequently. Frequently, they are duplicitous.
No,
and they have a
Seventh Heaven dad.
Yeah. Well, I will say that the majority of women, and it's 1 in 3 at this point in their lifetime, will be sexually assaulted. It's by somebody that they know. 85% of them will be assaulted by somebody that they know. So that part is not shocking. And actually, I don't like this characterization of egregious and monstrous and all this, because they're none of those things. What they are is insidious. They're syrupy sweet. And they're cloying. And they are abusers. And it's about power. It's not even about the sexual part of it. And that's what's so tricky about this whole use of the drug, because the drug that he used allegedly, Rohypnol, it's meant so that you do not remember immediately what happened. The goal of it is for you to wake up completely hazy. You don't really remember. And then 3 days later, your memories start to come back to you and you have a flash, somebody above you, somebody on top of you, you screaming no, them pulling you down. It's meant so that you cannot get justice. And that part is the insidious part to me. Now, because he could have sex with whoever the fuck he wanted to have sex with. It wasn't about the sex. That is what is egregious to me. That is the scary part to me. That is the part that I'm like, I find the silence of the adult women that were on that show in response to this interesting.
And I'll just, you know, we've talked on our podcast before. I have a friend that you know, was date raped using Rohypnol. And the way that she was treated, I was there. I went and got her from a hotel. She called me in a hotel room. I don't know where I'm at. I have no idea. I'm fucking freaking out. And I had to go get her and bring her to the hospital. The way that they treated her, it to this day makes my stomach fucking churn, you know, as the victim of a crime. And at the end, they took a blood test to see if she had been drugged, and they refused. They would not give her the results of that test unless she pressed charges. And what Leslie just said, you know, the drug's purpose is to make you not remember. And okay, I don't remember. So you have to then blindly go and press charges against somebody. Wouldn't the information about whether or not this this drug was in your system be pertinent to your decision on whether or not to press charges? It's our entire culture. It's the whole fucking, what was she wearing? What was she doing? It's absolutely, so when people say, oh, they're, you know, how come they didn't say anything? How could they come out? Because we fucking, we make it miserable for women to come out, especially against somebody that's powerful.
Yeah, for sure. It's an abuse of his power, and it has been his abuse of his power. And the fact that he did it over such a number of years, it just shows you that, you know, this is what he liked. You know, this is what he got off on. This is the ability to do this was what was driving him. And it's really, it's kind of gross. It's really disgusting to think about.
This whole talk is
it's terrible. Let's move on. We have some good stuff.
We have fun stuff to talk about?
We have a few good... we got some good stuff to talk about. Let's switch gears.
Something good's
got to
come out of this.
Yeah.
You want to talk about stop and frisk?
Well, yeah, stop and frisk could sound really freaky, too. But it's not. what we're talking about is a decrease in the crime rate in New York City.
That gets a ding.
So, yeah. New York City is right now at a historic low in terms of the murder rate. In 2013, it had the fewest murders recorded in any year in its history. The murder rate has gone down even despite the fact that they have suspended a lot of their stop and frisk policies where they stop you without just cause and search you, your person and your vehicle. And a lot of people are saying that the suspension of the policy would have contributed to a rise in homicides and crime, when in actuality, the suspension of the program has, I don't know if you can say it led to the decrease, but it's coincided with a considerable decrease in crime. So that's awesome news for New York City.
Yeah. And I pulled up a bunch of quotes. There was an article that had all the quotes that the fucking right wing bastards put. More Black Americans and more Hispanic Americans are going to die, said Fox News Bill O'Reilly.
What?
Like he gives a shit if they did. That's hilarious.
It gets worse. It will end in buckets of blood on the city streets, wrote the New York Post Andrea Pesser.
Okay. Even though all of the 99% of the stop and frisk resulted in absolutely nothing but dehumanization of the person being frisked. Okay, go ahead.
Blood of new crime victims will be on their hands, wrote the New York Post editorial board. Will the city once again become the crime capital of the world? The body count will start rising, wrote the New York Daily News editorial board. Wait till you hear about mushrooms and learn that the word refers to children who have been struck by stray bullets. Seriously? God. That was at the onset when they were talking about ending stop and frisk. That's what the fucking doom and gloom bastards were talking about.
Wow. I don't news anymore.
News is useless. They actually don't have any information whatsoever there. But it is good to see that the stop and frisk, and I'm interested to see the arrest statistics in D.C. now that they've decriminalized. Actually, they've legalized marijuana in D.C., but here in Philly, they've decriminalized it. So it's just a misdemeanor and a ticket. And I'm interested to see in the next 12 months from both of those decisions going forward, which in Philly was ridiculous because a city fucking councilman had to push to make this actually get implemented by our Black mayor and our Black police commissioner, because they've been making so much fucking money off of locking people up for these ridiculously small petty marijuana possession charges that they didn't even want to get rid of the money they were making.
Yeah.
And yeah, who served two different terms in Philly because of that. And it's like, now that he's out, it's like you could have gotten, you know, 5 years of your life back if they had just passed this sooner.
And I'm not saying it's a function of stop and frisk, but to your comment, Cheryl, the crime isn't just down. Murder was down 20% year over year, 20%. And the crime rate in New York was the lowest it's been since 1994. And again, let's not post hack ergo proctor hoc. It's not because stop and frisk, but it's interesting that.
No, but it is because stop and frisk. It's because the officers that were spending their time doing stop and frisk actually doing their fucking jobs. It is because of stop and frisk. Don't say that. It's not because of stop and frisk specifically, but it's because resources are being put in places where they need to be to actually prevent crime, because stop and frisk was not preventing anything.
No. And in fact, the statistics, we talked about it previously, they were more likely, they stopped African-American, Latino, black and brown people infinitely more frequently. Yet their own data, their own fucking data showed that they were more likely to find contraband on white people.
Because what? Did they think drug dealers got good at their job being stupid? Hello? Oh, you're searching black and brown people? Well, we won't be putting drugs on them anymore. Duh. It's not fucking rocket science. It's like, I don't even understand what they think. They think drug dealers are like, I don't know, henchmen from movies. This is real life. It's a business to them. They don't want people taking their drugs. You're so stupid. Oh.
Well, at any rate, I'm glad that Stop and Frisk has seemingly ended and not turned into the fucking bloodbath that Bill O'Reilly thought it would.
Yeah, now if we can get some sensible drug laws passed in New York City and get some sensible training for these police officers so they're not killing people on a regular basis, we'll be making some real progress there.
Yeah, one step at a time, I guess.
I guess, yes. That is true. This is good news.
It's
good news statistically, so that moving forward, they have these statistics to call forward when people are looking to make similar changes in other cities. So yeah. That's pretty big.
Well, let's talk about this other thing. I had a real interesting Twitter interaction, but I didn't hear much about what went on in maybe Toronto. This whole concept of, and again, I've said publicly, I do not like the word ally in terms of white people. Like, I think we white people can break our hands, patting ourselves on the back, like, I'm a white ally.
That's true. Y'all are bad at that shit.
Well, I heard somebody say that it's appropriate as a verb. Like, if you're being an ally, it's about what you're doing, but it's not appropriate as a noun. And I understand that, but I'm not a big fan of the term white ally. But so maybe, Leslie, get me caught up to speed on what happened in Canada.
Yeah, so there were several protests that were going along with the Tuesday protests in solidarity with Ferguson and in protests against the verdict from the grand jury. And so one of the organizers, this was in Ottawa and in Toronto, had posted on the Facebook page, this was what they posted to white/non-black allies. While we appreciate the solidarity shown by white and non-black people of color, we want to remind folks of a few things. One, please refrain from taking up spaces in all ways possible. Remember that you are here in support of black folk, so you should never be at the center of anything. Two, refrain from speaking to the media. Black voices are crucial to this. Number three, stand behind black folk or between us and the police. And then four, if you see a cop harassing a black person, come in and engage. Chances are they are least likely to arrest you as a white person or a non-black person. Okay?
That seems all very reasonable to me.
So this person put this up. These are guidelines. She's planning the event. He or she's planning the event, whatever. And it turned into this big, huge thing. Oh, why are you having a set of rules for the white people? It's reverse racism. It's not fair. I don't think it's right.
Did somebody call that reverse racism?
Yeah. How are you supposed to, help? And all these white people just like crying, wrote this woman all these notes about how terrible it was and how horrible it was. What do you think about it, Sherelle? About the rules and about how, with the reaction, I guess, to them?
I don't know. I could see how this could be taken the wrong way. Because, If I wanted to go and support, let's say, an LGBTQ rally and somebody told me not to take up space, I'd be like, what am I supposed to do, evaporate?
Yeah.
Like, that'd be annoying to me. But the rest of the rules I kind of understand, making sure that the people who it's about, their voices are heard. And I get that. And I think that there's nothing wrong with that. I think that this could have been worded way, way differently.
Yeah.
In a way that would have made people feel more inclusive. You want to encourage people to be part of this. You don't want to make them feel like they are intruding by being an ally. Like, it almost makes them seem like they're in the way and they should just go home. And we need every person to be there and to be in support. So, I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm taking the opposite stance, but I think you could be a little bit more welcoming to people. And yeah, I don't think it's cool to whine about the rally not being about you if you're not a person of color. I wouldn't tell you to do that. But at the same time, there's a way to talk to people.
That's definitely very valid. Drew, what were you going to say?
I I'm pretty hard on white people, and I'm, very white guy. I feel like a lot of the complaints sound like just it's their own privilege getting in the way. Like, oh, you know, we want to. If you're really that upset about it, look in the mirror. Why are you pissed about it? Are you really there because you want to be seen and have like, I'm down with the cause and try and win brownie points? Or are you really trying to make a difference? And if you're really trying to make a difference, in my opinion, as a white person, I take my cues and my leadership from people of color. Like with the street harassment thing, enough women said this just high is street harassment. I believe it. I'm okay. Done. Check. I'm going to take my cues from you and I'm going to err on the side of caution. And in this struggle, I, as a white person, I don't want to co-opt. I don't want to supplant. I don't want to hinder. I want to help. I want to be solidarity, not charity. And when you bitch and moan about, oh, you don't want me there, it sounds like you were there for the wrong reasons. And I'll just say my own personal experience. Right after Mike Brown's death, Leslie organized with Feminista Jones, the NMOS event here in Philadelphia. There was hundreds and hundreds of people, tons of media. There were talking, black, you know, leaders in Philadelphia are talking to the media. There was a point at which we were, you know, trying to read names of people that had been killed extrajudicially. And the crowd was kind of mulling and there were, you know, there was a lot of noise. And I've got a loud voice and I can, you know, speak really loudly. So I kind of gathered the crowd and said, hey, you know, listen, let's do this, let's do that. And I, in hindsight, I get it. I fed the media a soundbite. I absolutely understood what I did. I didn't mean to, but I did. But here's a fucking event in Philadelphia with like 90% people of color, you know, literally hundreds and hundreds, 400 or 500 people of color. There was reverends and ministers and leaders talking to the media. And where'd the fucking soundbite? What did they play? The white guy, me. And I just, it pissed me off. It was like, you know, so, and I, from the comments that the people in Canada said, don't talk to the media, I get that fully and completely. And the other thing I'll say, and I think that white people don't always get this, our privilege is so omnipresent that it fucks up our ability to be an ally, to be helpful. When we're trying to do good work, our privilege gets in the fucking way. I have another podcast I do called the White Privilege Podcast, and AKA Charles Wade was one of the folks that went to the Ferguson to Geneva. He mentioned that this happens, that, you know, the group in there and the leaders are all saying, hey, we're going to go left. We're going to go left. We're going to go left. And the last minute they say, you know what? Change of plans. We're going to go right. And all the white people are saying, oh, why are we going right? We were ready to go left. Why do we have to go right? And that right there is an indication of privilege. And so I, as a white person, and I've been told by people of color, you know, we don't fucking want you. I don't fucking want you. Get the fuck out of my face. I got this. I have to honor and respect that. I you know, and I had a bit of a Twitter fight last night because I had this exact dialogue. You know, what is it? You know, why are we trying to use this word ally? I don't like the word ally. When we, you know, try to do help, our privilege gets in the way. We fuck it up. And a person kind of came at me and said, oh, you've got to fight and be there. And even if a person of color says, don't get involved, you got to, you know, fight back. And I was like, you know what? No, I really honor and respect that opinion. And you know, maybe I don't agree with it, but if that's what you want, done. As a person who's there for you, you ask for my help and this is how you want my help. Absolutely 100. I'm on it. But again, that's me. I'm a white person. I just don't. You know, and I get that some people are thinking that this response is sort of like, you know, white people, we don't want your help. I don't read it as that way. I read it as, hey, white people, you continually fuck this thing up. So why don't you let us help you help us the way that we need it? And maybe I'm reading it wrong, but that's how I interpret it.
I see what you're saying. I think I'm hypersensitive to these things because I feel like just to get one of my white friends to even be remotely interested in what I'm doing is like so awesome that I'm like, I don't want to step on anyone's toes. Do you know what I mean? Like that's how bad it is to feel. We feel so isolated that even just to have someone want to be there, you want to include them as much as possible. But I do hear what you're saying, that if they're going to get in the way and they're going to be whiny about it and cry reverse racism, then they need to go. Yeah, for sure. But I think there's so many white people who don't even care enough to show up that I appreciate anyone who's interested.
And with your friends, and if you had that response, did some of them like, fine, you don't want my help, fine, I'll leave it, whatever. Is that what you get?
She hasn't done that to them.
No, I haven't. But I don't even think I would. I'm just saying that you know, there's been a few friends who've reached out to me over Facebook and asked me different questions about certain things going on in Ferguson or emailed me articles. And those people, I appreciate them because even some of the stuff they say is kind of backwards or, you know, like one of my friends was like, well, what if the protesters, because I posted something, MLK, he was talking about the rioters and in the picture shown, he was wearing a suit while he was being arrested. And the person said, well, what if the protesters all wore suits? Wouldn't that be a better way? And so I had to go through respectability politics with the person and explain the whole thing about, you know, when a woman gets raped, everyone wants to look at what she's wearing and all that. But I just appreciated the fact that the person even came up to me and asked those questions, even if it seemed somewhat out of line, I just was happy to even have the conversation to begin with. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. What about you, Leslie? What do you feel about this?
Well, having a lot of experience doing this work, I'll have to say that I understand exactly why those rules were put in place. And I don't find them to be too forward because unfortunately when you're dealing with large groups of people, you have to be forward. On a one-on-one basis, you do have the luxury of being tactful and being receptive to the other person's feelings. But when you're talking about a short period of time in a large mass action, you don't have those luxuries most of the time. And the message is so much more important than the feelings of the people involved that that has to become tantamount in terms of what you do. And unfortunately, with white people, they are so unaccustomed to taking their cues from black people that you really have to hit them over the head with it. They don't get it otherwise. I've been in this situation many times.
Amen.
And if you, honest to goodness, do not perfectly spell out for them that this is what you can do and this is what you can't do, what you end up with is arguing with them about what you want to do. And it becomes just one more obstacle to you getting to your goal. And also, they don't know how to frame the conversation. And unfortunately, with situations like this, where we're talking about moving from this moment to a movement, the message is incredibly important. We're working so hard to get a message out that mainstream media does not want to make something that they want to say. They don't want to say the things we want them to say already. We're already in a position where the mainstream media could give two shits about what the actual issues are at the heart of these protests and what we're trying to get across to them. And so as an organizer, you become very protective of what that message is visually, which is why the queue of please stand in the back and make sure that people of color in the front, verbally, which is why you don't want them speaking to the media, and you want to make sure that you have actual representatives who are very well versed in the talking points. And there are talking points when we go into these situations that we have written down, points we want to hit. Every person has three things we want them to always know when they're talking to the media in these situations. And it's not something that white people are going to be able to do. So from my perspective, it just comes into, unfortunately, how we have to do this work because we have so much working against us in trying to get our message out. We have so much working against us in trying to be effective that oftentimes, even though they do want to be supportive and they're there for support, you have to tell them what role that they'll be most
explicitly
useful in playing.
Tell them. Explicitly.
And you have to really tell them it. And it does come off a little bit jarring, but it almost needs to for them to get it. Honest to goodness, if you try to be nice about it, the subtlety would be lost on them because they're not used to being in this position of somebody of color saying, nope, you do this right now. It's so foreign to them, they can't grasp it fully. So they don't get subtlety. And so you have to be like, bitch, get back there. You can't talk to the press and stop.
Well, I understand that, but I guess what I'm confused about, maybe you can help me understand, is like the whole like not being seen. Because for me, like, wouldn't it be more helpful to have the protesters appear multicultural? Because then it's like everyone's protesting. Everyone thinks this is wrong, not just black people.
I think that the largeness of the crowd is that, but what they are trying to get across is that they want to make space for those that have not been heard. Because if that's what the goal is, we're showing solidarity for the people who have not been heard, they should be the forefront.
Mm.
Because, no offense, but I fucking heard from you, white people. I already know what you feel. And if you're here, it's pretty clear that you're supporting us. But we're trying to give voice to people that haven't been heard. And so it's really important for them to be in the forefront of things. I will say I do think that because this was in Canada, there's a potential for a language issue with regard to translation, especially because it was coming, I think it was in two different cities, and one of them was in the Quebec province, which is French. So there could be the whole like take up as little space as possible. I could see that being kind of a verbal issue there, but I get what they were trying to say. What they were trying to say was make sure that you're not taking up huge swaths of the crowd, that you mix in where you can and that you're not in the front. This was what they were trying to get across. And I get it. But I do think that there's this idea of, and I heard a lot of people saying it, that they don't like these rules for white allies or whatever they want to be called. And I said, no, anybody who says that has never tried to organize anything like this, because lamentably, you have to have a lot of rules. These things don't come off without planning. They don't come off without you thinking of every contingency. They don't come off with you literally not being like, okay, we need to have security people stationed in these six areas on the perimeter. We need to have clergy and legal observers in these four sections where we think we're going to be meeting the front lines of the police. These are the things that organizers have to think about. I don't think most people understand the complexities and stress that goes into attempting to do this kind of mass movement. And I'm not talking about a few hundred people. I'm talking about thousands of people that were in Toronto and Ottawa. It's a lot that goes into it. And it's very easy to give them a soundbite, like Drew mentioned, where all you hear on the news on repeat is a big white guy saying this thing over and over and over again. And I can only imagine how angry all of the black people that gave all of their beautifully well-written, super eloquent, and really amazing sound bites to these people getting home, sitting down to watch the news, and there's Drew.
And I was pissed. I'm just saying. I was mad. I was literally mad about it.
But it doesn't matter if you were mad.
It's irrelevant that I'm mad, but my point was like, God fucking damn it. Are you serious? 90% of the people here are black women and men, and you fucking ran the white dude over and over and over again? God damn it.
I'm like every station. The freaking Telemundo.
I asked for people to be quiet, and again, I have a loud voice. We weren't as prepared as we are now, so we didn't have a megaphone, we didn't have a loudspeaker, and I stood up on a little bit of a pedestal, and I said, you know, hey, everyone, be quiet, and I was asking for names to be read. We had a list of names. We handed out pieces of paper with list of names of people that had been killed extrajudicially, and I said, we're going to read the names of these people aloud, and we're going to do it because a person of color is killed every 28 hours. And that was what I said. Every 28 hours, a person of color is killed extrajudicially by the police. And that's all you saw. Every fucking news station. There's Drew. Every 28 hours. And again, I get it. It was a soundbite. I didn't mean it. I didn't intend it.
But it got comical. I mean, he was on Telemundo. Like, literally.
NBC, ABC,
and
Fox,
they spoke
CBS,
to Spanish people that everyone. Were there. We have Spanish people here. They were at the rally. They were there. So it just gets to be where you really have to think. And I think it is something that was born out of the National Moment of Silence, because a lot of these organizers that you see organizing again and again and again, it's the same team of people, same group of organizers, and they've learned. They're like, okay, we can't put it to chance anymore. We can't allow it to be shaped by somebody else. We have to really actively decide what this is going to look like, what this is going to occur like, what this is going to sound like. You have to think about all of those things.
Especially because of what you said before, Leslie, because the media is deliberately skewing the narrative.
Yeah.
They're taking shit out of context intentionally. So people of color really got to work extra hard. And white people, and I say this about white people that are trying to be helpful, and I'll just use I statements. I've fucked it up. I'm telling you, I lose sight of my own privilege, like, all the fucking time.
We had this argument last night because you were going on, you, all of you white people have been on Twitter all night last night, you guys were talking about.
No.
Should you be an ally?
Listen, stop.
Email?
Before you put on the bus, I started by saying I do not like the word ally.
Right, I get that.
I don't use the word ally.
What's that got to do with anything?
Because before you started saying about what we're doing, I said I don't like the word ally.
You still, that was the gist of the conversation.
I said I don't like the word.
Right.
I'm not going to use it.
Right.
I don't like it. And a lot of the people on my timeline started coming back and forth. And so now you can say, I just want to make it clear, I don't like the word. I wasn't trying to use the word.
I didn't say you were. My point was you were having a discussion about the word, regardless of what your stance was. You were having a discussion about the word.
Other
all
people
of you,
were having a discussion.
You were in the discussion too.
It was on my timeline.
Okay. That sounds like you were in it to me.
Okay.
So you were in the discussion too. You all were discussing, well, what could be used? What other words would there be? Da, 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 da. And I looked at you and I said, why the fuck are you guys so important? Why do you need a title?
Yeah, I agree. And I said right away, that's a very privileged stance for white people to think that they need to anoint themselves in some way as an ally, as a friend, as an apprentice ally. And I tweeted that this morning. I said, really?
Who cares?
I literally, as a white person, I always say this. We're going to fuck up. And when we do, I'll say it now. Thank you, Leslie, for checking my privilege. I appreciate it. I'll do better.
But it's just funny to me because it's beyond just the privilege thing. It's that was, you guys were supposed to be trying to work on these issues, right? And any amount of time that you spent discussing on what people were going to call you makes me laugh. It's really funny, though.
It's a privileged stance. And
it's not just a privileged stance. It's like that's what your brain was occupied with. Whoever was in the discussion, even if it wasn't you.
I find it
funny.
Your brain gets occupied with a lot of shit.
Sure.
It literally was because I was setting out a bunch of tweets about white people. Because I speak from my perspective as a white person, mm-hmm. of privilege, as a white male, grew up with all the, you know, trappings of privilege. And I'm saying, hey, if you're trying to be, you know, in this movement, here's what you got to do. And it was all the stuff that you and I talk about.
Right.
You got to fucking listen. You got to fucking. And the thing that got me in hot water was if a person of color says, fuck you, I don't want you involved in this. And that's this one person not speaking about all people of color. But if they tell me that, I got to respect that. And a bunch of people came at me like, no, you don't. You got to, you know, you need to be there for them. I was like, okay, whatever. So that was what the original discussion was. But this morning I tweeted, I said, you know, hey, thanks Leslie Mack for checking my privilege. You're right. I am, you know, why the fuck do we white people need any sort of annotation? You know, we're fighting for social justice just like people of color.
Yeah.
Do black people, because they're all black, just get lumped into working for this? There's Don Lemons out there, right? Like they're not, you know, you're not a monolith of people.
I thought I told you his name is not allowed on this podcast no more.
but people of color don't have any sort of designation. Why do white people need one?
Yeah, I don't know why you do.
And I absolutely, as soon as you said, I'm like, oh fuck, she's right. Yeah. What a ridiculously privileged fucking, you know, series of fucking tweets. So I said it this morning. I said, I refuse to use any word. It's no longer ally. I'm just aggressively fighting racism. That's
all you need to say, right?
Yeah, that's all I need. There's nothing else beyond that. I aggressively fight racism. Mm-hmm. Done.
Good. Good on you, Drew.
Thank you.
Way to go.
But like I said, and that's why I think when you look at, you know, this stuff in Canada, like that's why that letter was written.
Yeah.
Because otherwise white people fuck it up. And the other thing we haven't even talked about, which I have my own personal opinion. I've seen this happen. There's a real subtle kind of undercurrent when white people are in this movement. That's almost like, I don't want to say it this way, but it kind of feels like black people need to acquiesce to whiteness. Like
the goal is
sort of like you need to be more white.
No, you got it wrong. What it is, and this is something that I have noticed, is that because black people in this country are not given the chance to shine the way that they should, there's an assumption on white people's part that we don't have the skills to do what
Maybe
needs
what
to be
is.
Done. No, I'm telling you, this is what it is. So they come in and they're like, ooh, I do PR for such and such, so you need my expertise. As if I don't have 16 master's degree PR agents standing behind me that happen to be people of color. They don't understand that that's the case. Like, I don't need a white code writer. I have 13 black code writers that don't get a chance already standing right behind me right now. So this is what they bring to the...
You're talking about the white knight. Like, yes, I'm going to come save you.
They think they have skills that people of color don't have. And that's where the friction often comes in when you're in this planning mode.
You're right about
that. It's been something really interesting here in Philly working with this big kind of large organization that we've been recalling ourselves, for lack of a better phrase, Ferguson to Philly. And it's made up of representatives from about six or, well, I think eight by now, different local organizations. And they range from people, organization from Temple University to, you know, a socialist party group to a Latina activist group to National Moment of Silence, which is my group. So it's a bunch. It's a really big collective. And we have old people and white people and black people and Hispanic people and young people. It's been really great working together because you see these dynamics play out within us. And it allows us to be more informed when we go to deal with the larger group of people that are going to be working with us. And so you see these things play out within the 12 of us or 13 of us. And then you think, we will even discuss it. We're like, ooh, that was a little rough. We can't have this happen when everybody else is here. So what are we going to do to make sure it doesn't happen in our breakout groups? Or what are we going to make sure it doesn't happen during the events? So it's a lot about interpersonal skills. But unfortunately, sometimes you have to be blunt, lamentably.
And let me ask you this of both of the two of you. As a white person, when I read or hear you read that statement from Canada, nothing in that tells me we don't want white people. Nothing in that says white people go home. Nothing in that says white people get the fuck out of here. Is that sure? Also, you had some issues with it. Does it sound like that to you?
To me, yeah, that's what it sounded like.
Really?
Yeah. If I went to like a, I don't know, person with disabilities rally, and they were like, Sherelle, don't take up space. Sherelle, go stand in the corner. Sherelle, don't you dare be on the camera. I'd be like, adios.
Okay.
Like, I don't know. That's just the way I took it. I think the main thing was a don't take up space thing, and maybe that was the language thing.
Yeah.
Maybe.
That to me just seemed really rude.
Yeah.
And what about the concept that we're talking about, that, you know, there's an absolute need, in my opinion, I think Leslie's opinion, for people of color to be front and center with not just the narrative but the actual work, right? So for the
For sure. I think that's definitely important. I just think that there's just a way of handling it, I think that it's a little bit more tactful. I don't think any of the motivations behind it are wrong at all.
Yeah.
I just think that initial reading those lists of rules without any
context.
It wasn't communicated properly.
Yeah, and I could totally see that. But I've heard people say, like, they don't like that there would be any rules. They don't think it's fair that there would be any rules for being out. And like, if you're planning something, I hate to tell you, but there got to be rules.
Honestly, no, I know, no. Leslie, you've seen it. I've seen it on Twitter. We white people, we fuck it up all the time. We literally fuck it up all the time. So I get it.
It's not about fucking it up, though. It's just a matter of, you know, you're not in the position to make decisions in this arena.
Right.
You're just not. It's not something you're trained for. It's not something that you can speak from in a real place in most instances. And so you shouldn't be taking the lead. Just like I wouldn't go into, I don't know, a circus tent and try and tell the ringmaster what to do. I don't know anything about that shit. So if he needs my help, I'll stand on the side and I'll hold a bar or something if that's what he needs me to do. But I'm not going to try and, you know, tame tigers. I don't know how to do those things. So that's where I feel like the message should come from. It shouldn't be from a exclusionary point, but it should be in a, hey, listen, we're running this thing and this is how we need it to run. And that's how it should have been communicated.
Yeah.
Should have been communicated from an organizational standpoint, not from a personal one. And it did seem as though it could be received personally. And that's where, you know, when I craft the messages, I always like to make it, you know, it's great that you're here. I really love it, but this is what we need.
Yeah,
that's where you have to come from.
You know what though, but it's again, white people, it's not about you. It's not about you. It's not about you.
But it is about all of us, though.
It is.
But and so part of that is you have to learn how to work with whoever is going to show up. It's not an easy thing when you put a general call out to people for lots of things. And I'm sure, Sherelle, in your work, you deal with this all the time, dealing with the general public, is that people come into things with their own expectations, with their own motivation, with their own agenda. And when you're trying to be the one corralling this, it gets tricky sometimes.
Yeah, definitely. I think you need rules in, you know, in every time you're dealing with, you know, groups of people who've never been with, worked with before, groups, whatever, what have you. I think that's always, you know, something that you need. I just think it's, there's, you know, a PR aspect to it. And mm-hmm. there's a way of making people feel, it's like telling someone to go to hell and making them enjoy the ride.
Yeah. Right.
And you know, maybe if it had been, like you said, the language barrier, if there had been a bit of a paragraph on the front and it said, here, listen, why this is why we're making right. this request. And then maybe even the word rules versus request. We're making a request, and here's why we're making this request. Please understand and appreciate and respect this request. That might have changed it a little bit.
I think so.
And I'm sure the organizer probably has never done anything like this before. I would say that in this movement, you see that more than anything else. People who have never felt the need to be called to social service. People have never organized anything like this in any way, but they felt like they had to do something and nobody had done it where they were, so they decided to do it. And so they're inexperienced, but they also have access to information that would inform them about how it should go. And so there's a little bit of a gap there.
Hmm.
And that was a lot of the stuff that they did during Ferguson October, when people went to Ferguson to do all of these days of trainings and things like that. And they focused on how you build a movement, how you organize people, how you know, there's skills you have to do it. So I'm encouraged by the number of people that have never done this work before that are getting into it. I think it's fantastic, but that's what creates a lot of these little, you know, stumbling blocks that you see. And the problem is when white people are involved, they turn it into that being the story now.
It's about me.
Because if this was older black people that had come and they had said, listen, this is a young people's thing, and we really want the older people to stay in the back and only let younger people talk, I guarantee you nary old black person would have said goddamn thing about it.
And you just hit on we've talked on our podcast a bunch of times that the movement currently is not the traditional top-down hierarchy. And if this had been a traditional top-down hierarchy, there would have been a more well-crafted message that every organizer would have had. Here's what you read. Here's how it goes. But that's not how this is working.
And I think that's coming. I think that you'll start to see much more tools put together. I think you'll start to see for the Hands Up walkout today, there were some very specific guidelines that were sent to people that organized. So you'll start to see it evolve. I think that, you know, it's just a part of the movement growing, changing.
It's a growing
and
pain.
Stretching itself and seeing what is out there. But I just thought it was an interesting way to look at the intricacies of a movement and planning one, and the difficulties you run into when it's a movement surrounding such a hot potato, so to speak, in race dealing with
I'll say for any white people listening, don't let that turn you off. You know, if somebody says something like that and you decide like, fuck it, I'm out, like you weren't here for the right reason anyway.
Well, no, you can be offended and say, fuck it, I'm out, but then go do something else. That wasn't the thing for you. That's
fair
okay.
Enough. Fair enough.
And that's fine.
Yeah, don't give up.
If you don't want to be in the back and not be able to speak to the press, that's great. Go and do something where you are able to do that. Go talk to white people about it and then talk about that experience. There's lots of things. We need so much to be done to move the needle that any pulling is worth it. And so I always say to people, if it doesn't feel right to you, that's fine. There'll be somewhere else in the movement that will feel right to you. And you should go until you find that thing and then put everything you can into it. So don't be discouraged if that's not what you want. I'm not actually one to plan things. I'm a good planner, but that's not my strong suit. I'm good at distilling information. I'm good at getting people to a table together. I'm good at, you know, getting information out to people. So that's why I focus my energies in.
Apparently I'm good at tweeting and making 2-second sound bites for ABC News.
And Telemundo.
And Telemundo. I don't know if there's much need for that from very white guy, but meh.
It's there. So the last things that we wanted to talk about were you had gone through with me yesterday and you wanted to talk about different types of apologies.
Yeah. So we've, Sheryl, I don't know if you heard on our podcast, we've talked before about the, and we've been sort of distilling this theory, this hypothesis. So there's an actual apology. And just for clarification, Leslie, I'm very sorry I did that to you. I can see how much I hurt you with that. And I'm deeply apologetic. I'm so sorry. That's an apology, right? Like it's right. Direct. It's I did this. I'm sorry. So then the non-pology, or we call the no-pology rather, sorry, the next one, is where they kind of it's not even really an apology. They sort of dance around and they'll make sort of various excuses like, well, you know, I do something. It's like, oh, I didn't really mean to do it. And I'm not really, that wasn't my intent. And I really meant to do this. And I meant to do that, where the words "I'm sorry" never come out your mouth, right? You're making like excuses in hindsight for what you did. That's the no apology. And then there's the non-apology.
That's the worst one.
You think the non-apology is the worst?
That's the one that just pisses me off, the non-apology.
So the non-apology is sort of like, I'm sorry you're offended. Like, it's really not, I'm not apologizing for what I did. So it's not an apology at all.
I'm sorry if I did anything to upset you. No, bitch, you upset me. How about you be sorry for that?
So we had someone that is in our circle that we had to come up with a new one, the unpology. And I'll just use their phrase exactly. The unpology is, I'm sorry I don't have the words to not upset you.
Oh.
Right? It's even worse. Like, the non-apology is like, I'm sorry you're upset. Like, at least the, like, I'm sorry that, like, what I did upset you. But the unpology is like, oh, I'm sorry I don't have the words to say that I'm sorry that you're upset. What?
Well, and what do you call this one? Because I've had someone sort of almost go on the attack with their apology, where I said to them, you know, you hurt my feelings, and I'm, you know, I was offended by what you said, and they said, well, I'm offended that you're offended.
Oh my God.
What?
We have to add to that. What will we call that?
I gotta think about what the hell to call that one.
Because I would never offend you, so I'm offended that you are offended.
I have had that. I've had that where it's like, I'm offended you would even think that I would think that way. Oh yeah, I've had that before.
How about the agri-apology? Were they aggressive? The agri-apology. I'm mad that you're mad. I'm mad that you're mad that I'm mad that you're mad.
Our dogs do that, where they're like, I'm mad. No, I'm going to get madder. No, you're madder. No, I'm madder than that.
Well, I'll leave it to you and Ricky Shaw. You come up with the description. That's a good, you're right. That's worse than there's the apology, the no apology, the non-apology, the unpology, and whatever you're going to call this, agri-apology, the fucking, I don't even think the word apology should be in there.
I don't think so. There's no
the attack.
Apology.
The attack.
The attack. Well, speaking of non and unpologies, one Elizabeth Lawton, the former now communications director for Representative Stephen Fincher, Republican from Tennessee, por supuesto, resigned Monday following a Facebook post that criticized Malia and Sasha Obama's appearance at the annual White House turkey pardon ceremony. So this is what she said in her original Facebook rant. Dear Sasha and Malia, I get that you're both in those awful teen years, but you're part of the first family. Try showing a little class. At least respect the part you play. Then again, your mother and father don't respect their positions very much, or the nation for that matter. So I'm guessing you're coming up a little short in the good role model department. Nevertheless, stretch yourself. Rise to the occasion. Act like being in the White House matters to you. Dress like you deserve respect, not a spot at a bar. And certainly don't make faces during televised public appearances.
Wow.
That was my Elizabeth Lawton.
You should be shoplifting from Belk.
Yes.
And so what happened? She got fired?
She didn't get fired. She resigned today. But she then took to Facebook on Saturday to apologize for her rant. This is the most bullshit-ass apology I've ever heard in my entire life. For real, I'm not even kidding. If I ever see this bitch, I might slap her in the face. This apology is so ridiculous. Quote, she starts off with the non-apology and then transitions to an unapology right quick.
She gets them both in?
She hits both of this shit. I reacted to an article and quickly judged the two ladies in a way that I would never have wanted to be judged myself as a teenager, because she was a drunk, by the way. After many hours of prayer, what the fuck does God have to do with this? I don't know.
Prayer.
Talking to my parents. That's great that you talked to your parents about this. You're a grown-ass woman.
Both of those are really mean outrage, mm-hmm. right? After public outcry. Mm-hmm.
And rereading my words online. So, did you not reread it before you wrote that shit? You just wrote it and hit send? Okay, whatever. I can see more clearly how hurtful my words were. Please know that these judgmental feelings truly have no place in my heart. This bitch didn't even say I'm sorry. Furthermore, Listen, here comes the apology. I'd like to apologize to all of those who I've hurt and offended with my words.
Not Sasha and Malia?
And pledge to learn and grow, and I assure you I have from this experience, end quote. Listen.
How about I'm sorry, Sasha and Malia?
She not only didn't actually say sorry to Sasha and Malia, this bitch didn't even say their name. She said the two young ladies. Yet, in her bullshit-ass attack on them, she wrote it directly to them. Dear Sasha and Malia, bitch, you roasted these children directly, spoke to them. And then, in your bullshit-ass response, said you wanted to apologize to whoever you offended. How about you apologize to the young children? Let me just make that clear again. Children that you, as a grown-ass woman, thought it was okay to come for publicly. As a communications director for a representative of your fucking state. Are you kidding me right now?
That's got to go in like the non-unpology hall of fame. That's unbelievable.
Epic. And the sad part is this bitch will write a book next year about it. I guarantee fucking to you. I'm not. What I learned from my Facebook rant by Elizabeth Lawton. I'm calling it now. Honest to goodness. The whole thing pissed me off. I was already like on like 10 with the entire gist of her thing, considering the fucking drunk twins that the Bushes had and all the shit that was going on with the Reagan kids when they were in office, and ever from the history of first children, none of them are good. Sasha and Malia are about as fucking, no pun intended, Cosby Show perfect as you could fucking get for people in the White House. These two girls have never done a goddamn thing to embarrass anybody, much less their parents or this nation. And for her to say that they were dressed like they were at a bar, they're fucking 13 and 16 years old. They were literally wearing like a sweater and a skirt to watch their dad bless two goddamn turkeys. The fuck is wrong with these people?
It's crazy.
Right, and wasn't she a shoplifter?
She was a shoplifter when she was a teenager. She got a record.
What is she talking about?
I guess that's what she was reflecting on. She got home and her mom was like, bitch, we had to pick you up at the fucking drunks, Hank.
That's exactly. Crazy.
What you talking about? Remember that time? Yeah. I had to pay off a judge. You remember that?
It's fucking crazy.
You're lucky you got to be a communications director. That's because I know Steven personally. That's exactly what they said to her when she came home. They were like, look here, little girl. This is going to come out. You better get your shit together right now. It's not going to look pretty. These pictures of her, she's got like a bottle hanging out of her mouth. It's fucking hilarious.
And you know, I guess I'm not looking for a silver lining, but like, it seems nowadays, like it used to be like, oh, I'm going to go to rehab and, you know, for my horrible racism. But now it's like, I'm going to double down like Piers Morgan, like, I'm going to repeat my statements. At least this bitch fucking, I guess, tried to apologize. I don't know. This is ridiculous.
She did not try to apologize. There's nothing in this that's an apology. She made it. Let me see here. First line, bullshit. Second line, excuse. More excuses. Third excuse. About her, about her, about her. No apology. About her, about her, about her. That's what that was.
And she ended with, I'm sorry for the people I hurt.
That was the no apology.
Not Sasha Malia.
She never even mentions these two girls. And she wrote the entire thing as a direct, like, she expected them to read this. That their mother and father, I'm sorry, the president and first lady of this goddamn United States of America were not good enough role models for them. That's what she said.
And if
that's not something you think would be offensive to somebody?
Let's go back a second. If anybody in the years 2000 to 2008 had said boo about the motherfucking Bush twins, Elizabeth Hasselbeck and her whole fucking Teacot crew would have fucking just
eviscerated
them.
First of all, they did. That one, which one is it? Jenna, the one that looks like the dad? She was drunk all the time, falling downstairs. There's tons of pictures of her drunk.
Yeah, but
off
people
her
didn't. People weren't bashing her on fucking Facebook.
No, like the tabloids were, but certainly not the communications director for any Democratic senator was not going to make a statement in public about the president's children. The president's children. Are you kidding me? I just the fact that the entire this entire situation is just so indicative of the treatment that this president and his family and his administration has had to face simply because he's black. Because I can tell you one goddamn thing. They never said shit about Chelsea Clinton.
Nope.
I'm not saying she did or didn't do anything, but it was like, I remember there was one, she wasn't the most attractive young lady when she was going through her teen years in the White House. And I remember vividly, because I was the same age as her, I remember there was some, she had gotten braces and somebody made a comment and it was like, you'd have thought that, you know, Putin had come over here and kidnapped her. Like, don't you dare talking about the first daughter. That's the president's, you know, child and rightfully so. I thought it was great. People were really hard about it. And it's like, you see this now and it's like, it's only because they're black. It's only, every time I see this, the disrespect that nobody even, you see it in articles. They don't even have the fucking decency to say President Obama, just Obama. When have you ever seen that?
Never.
Never in the history of media in this country have you seen major news outlets refer to the President of the United States by just their last name. Not once. Even when they're president-elect, it's president-elect whoever. Always.
Right. It's just blatant disrespect. And for this lady to say that the Obama daughters are classless or that they need to show some class, she's the one who needs to show some class by knowing how to actually refer to people who are, you know, running the nation by disrespecting the first lady, disrespecting the president, saying that they don't care about their country and that they're, you know, they're not good role models. I mean, that's not classy.
No. Although I do have a theory about the word classy itself. Anytime someone refers to themselves as classy, it's the first indication that they're anything but.
Or like, yeah, like someone's like, I'm so humble.
You're
like,
no, you're not.
That's my favorite.
Nope.
I'm really humble and classy.
Classy is the worst. Every time somebody says, I'm so classy, I'm like, oh, God. That means you are the most classless ratchet, bitch and ratchet person I will ever encounter in my life.
It's the equivalent of like, you know, I'm not a racist, but here comes some really horrible fucking racist shit. Yeah. I'm not a racist, but I'm about to say some racist as shit fucking comment.
So, oh gosh, yes. Well, I think that brings us to the end of the show, but we always end with podcast. Well,
no, we got to do friends of the podcast.
You have to do it.
It wanted to take me a minute.
All right, go on with your friends.
So I'm gonna ask you left or right? My left or my right?
I guess right.
My right? Damn it.
Why?
I was hoping you're going to pick left.
Then I picked left.
Yes. Well,
why don't you just do what you want to do?
So I have music that I want, and I don't have to mute your microphone, so you're not able to talk this. But I have music to play for our friends of the podcast, and one was really, really white, and one was not white. So I'll play you both, but we're going to do the white music. So give me just a second.
Oh Lord!
You can't talk. I got to turn your mic down. This is my white friends of the podcast music. My best friend. So, friends of the podcast, we've got Mr. Avery Brown. Thank you, Mr. Avery Brown. Juliet Claudine, Unruly Julie, Reverend Julie. Thank you, Reverend Julie. Carl Marr, the original Johnner. Carl Marr. Sean Jordan, Amy Steven, Clove and Sherley, otherwise known as Chonilla.com, Chonilla Podcast. Ricky and Sherelle, who's on here with us right now. Hello, Sherelle, thank you. Lee Crying Wolf, thank you. I am Lisa B. Thank you, I am Lisa B, being a friend of the podcast. Tia Marr. Thank you, Tia. Sarah Mello. I didn't know you were listening to the podcast, but Sarah, thank you so much. And Teddy Afro Sr. And I've got a story, Teddy Afro. He and I had an interaction. But Teddy Afro, thank you for being a friend of the podcast. So that was the courtship of Eddie's father. And in case you were wondering, my black music. We'll just let it play for a minute.
Never met a girl that you tried to date, but a year to make love, she wanted you to wait.
We'll turn Leslie's mic back on because I know she's dying to talk. So that was the Friends of the Podcast. Thank you for letting me do that, Leslie.
That's good. I like it. I like the Friends of the Podcast. That's good. And thank you, all of those friends. I'll give a special shout out to Unruly Julie because I think it's Unruly Rev.
It is Unruly Rev. Okay. You're right.
It's Unruly Rev. She's really irreverent, and she is fucking unruly.
I'm sure there are listeners I left off. So we'll just remind you, if you want, leave a review, iTunes, Stitcher, 5 stars. We'll read it on air. If you tweet me or Leslie or Interracial John that you're liking the show, listening to the show, I'll add you to the Friends of the Podcast, and maybe we'll put you on Biz Markie or Courtship of Eddie's Father. But we'll read you. Thank you.
Right. So we always end the show podcasting. So this week we're podcasting for the AUA Hope Podcast. Woohoo!
Yay!
And this podcast focuses on uplifting Americans' body, mind, and spirit with positive and inspiring content. And they have a special piece that they do, which is called the Ray of Hope, and they focus on a specific person to do an interview. Is that right, Sherelle? For the Ray of Hope part? Awesome. Mm-hmm. So the most recent episode, you did an interview with Dr. Morris, who is a spinal stenosis and disc treatment doctor, and he helped you as well. He's your doctor, correct?
Absolutely, yes. And he helped me go from like complete immobility, 7 months of crutches, to walking and totally repaired without surgery.
Amazing. The interview is insane. It's so good. Dr. Morris is so engaging and so just brings a lot of realism and heart to the story of how he got to be the practice that he has now and the work that he does helping people live full lives when most of the time they've been told that they can't. And yeah, it's really amazing, and it really is a ray of hope. And I highly recommend that everybody subscribe to the AUA Hope Podcast, and you can find them, as Sherelle mentioned, at the top of the program at auamovement.org is the website, and you can also find them on Twitter at AUADOT.org, and on Facebook, just search for Americans United Again, and you can also find them on Beanpod, right? AUAHope.beanpod.podbean. That's, I always get that one wrong for some reason. AUAHope.podbean.com as well. And for email, it's AmericansUnitedAgain@gmail.com. And if you are writing about the Hope Show, just put that in the subject line. Make sure you put Hope in there.
And I meant to tell you, we were talking before we got on to the recording, I really think you hit on it, that it's interesting that as a doctor, there's almost an inherent desire to keep you being medicated, right? Mm-hmm. Like the Hippocratic Oath is to like see you improved, but then if you improve the person and they stop seeing you, you lose money. It's kind of, there's a weird, and I thought that that your doctor specifically was really aware of that, and at least it, to me, came across as, I want to help you. I want to, my job is to see you better, not to see you paying me for the next 10 years.
Absolutely. And I think one of the biggest things is because of his personal journey. Mm-hmm. He was disabled for 12 years and went from being on the track to being an Olympiad to sitting on his couch, like unable to move. So when you go from that, and he was also like a high profile sports medicine doctor working with the Clippers and Olympians himself, when you go from that to not being able to do your job anymore, it sort of changes you and changes your ethics. And I think he just wanted to help people get their lives back the way that he was able to get his life back.
Well said.
Absolutely. So we obviously highly recommend checking out AUA Hope, and also the original AUA podcast, which is also amazing. You guys do, I think the AUA podcast is what, every 2-3 weeks, and the Hope one you do once a month. Is that right, Sherelle?
Yes, yeah. That's correct.
Awesome. So definitely, and I know Ricky does his one-off interviews as well. He had a great one last week talking about boycotting as strategy. So definitely check out the Americans United Again movement, generally speaking. And thank you, Sherelle, for being with us tonight.
Yeah,
it was so awesome.
And let's,
you're welcome, and thank you for like supporting us. I mean, you guys have been really great, and we really appreciate you for bringing both Ricky and I on, and you know, telling your listeners about our shows, and you know, just your overwhelming support. It means a lot to both Ricky and I.
No, thank you for what you guys do, and thank you for Jingle Palette.
Oh, I mean, gosh. But I heard Ricky palette. Has a new
Sorry,
toy.
Leslie.
I heard he has a new toy, though, doesn't he?
He does, and he's always playing.
I'll tweet him. I'll DM him.
Oh,
yeah. I'll get the 411. And I want to give a quick plug. I'm going to be recording the next episode of the White Privilege Podcast, and we've got lined up Bazem Masri. He's a live streamer, individual that was in jail in Ferguson over the weekend, and we're pleased that he's going to be coming on the show. We'll be recording that this Wednesday. Hopefully have that live Wednesday night as well, and you can find that on the Interracial John website, Stitcher, through podcast, iTunes, various places, just IRJ White Privilege.
Absolutely. And as always, you can follow us on Twitter at Interracial John. That's JAWN. You can follow me personally at Leslie Mack, and
me at Very White Guy.
Awesome. Well, thanks for joining us again, Sherelle, and we'll talk to everybody soon.
Thanks.
High five. All right. We're all good. Thanks, Sherelle.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me. It was.